Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Good morning and welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm your host, Dave Gagan, and this is where we try to simplify spirituality. Today's show is titled Mysticism. Being seekers of wisdom, we need to search all areas to understand what's available to us. Today, we're going to talk to Dr. Andrew Vidic. Dr. Vidic is an author, educator, transformational speaker, and editor of more than five books. His books include Love is a Secret, which was critically acclaimed by the Institute of Noetic Sciences. He co-authored Heart of the Healer, an investigation into the nature of healing, and he was also a contributor to Heart of Healing, which won a National Book Award for Best Anthology on Health and Healing. His most recent book, Light Upon Light, Five Master Pathways to Awaken the Mindful Self, won the Best Book Award under the category of Eastern Religions by the USA Book News. Dr. Vidic has been an adjunct assistant professor of religion at Manhattan College and at Iona College in New Rochelle, where he taught courses in the nature and experience of religion, meditation, death and dying, and Islamic studies. Dr. Vidic appears on radio and TV shows, and he also lectures, presents seminars, and does workshops at corporations, educational and religious institutions, and at conferences throughout the world on a variety of leadership topics. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Vidic.
My great pleasure, David.
Before I get into the heart of the interview, I'd like to have your thoughts on a few issues. Now, if there is anything in the world which seems to be dividing us, it's religion. We don't care what sports people like. We don't care what they eat or where they work. We don't even care that much about their political systems of choice. But we care a great deal about what their religious beliefs are. Now, you're a professor of religion and a member of Interfaith Council. Why do you think religion's so divisive?
Well, in a nutshell, the problem is not with the faith. The problem is with the faithful. So it's not a question of the essential teachings of these great spiritual teachers who have the founders of these great religions. It is a question of the interpretation of these traditions, and I would say also the misuse of these traditions for political, economic, and social ends that have nothing to do with actual religion. So it's really a question of misinterpretation rather than actually a problem of the religion itself.
Okay. Now it seems to me that it's more of a Western or a Abrahamic problem. You know, you don't see in the history books and in the papers where the Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism, where they seem to be anywhere nearly as aggressive as you get out of well, if you look at Judaism, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago in the the Old Testament or Christianity 1,500 years ago or Islam today, they seem to be more aggressive. Any thoughts on that?
Well, sadly, viewpoint is only part of the picture. When we look at the misinterpretation of religion, we see that there have been also great tragedies within the Hindu tradition, Sikh tradition, and so on and so forth. But I caution readers to understand that this is the problem, again, is not with the original intention of the founders. The problem is how are the religions actually practiced and the misinterpretation of the original teachings. So, and just to give you an example, we had a great horrific tragedy in the partition of India where millions of Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs were killed purely over religious differences. And that's not something people like to talk about, and it's not something we want to bring up again. But unfortunately, so long as human beings are inflicted with violence and hatred, they will use their religion, they'll use their politics, and they'll use any means possible to justify their ends. And this is more or less what we see. I want to make one other point here. And I think this is germane to what you're saying, and that is that when we look at each religious tradition, and we actually go into the teachings of the traditions, we will find certain statements that are often taken out of context within a particular tradition, and then bandied about and used in the wrong ways. And so this can account for a great deal of the misinterpretation, including the Crusades, which were clearly an example of the misuse of religion for political ends. So I think we have to be very careful and not blame the religion, not be quick to blame the religion and the original, the teachings of the great founders, but look at the politics and the context around which these battles and these things have arisen.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That makes a lot of sense. It's really the nice thing about religion, at least if, you know, for somebody who's a fanatic, they can say, well, I'm going to the highest power to be on my side, and that's clearly God, so he must be on my side, so I'm going to justify everything I do with his name, as opposed to a political system where people wouldn't care that much.
Yeah, that's very true, and you know, there's a interesting comment someone made about the description of a zealot or a fanatic, and that description is someone who has all passion and zealousness, but has actually forgotten the goal.
I like that.
Meaning the goal is peace and harmony. And all great religious traditions have said emphatically that hatred produces hatred, violence produces violence, and it is never a solution to anything. And this includes the Islamic tradition, of which very people have almost no understanding of, let alone have they ever read the actual scripture or the context in which certain statements have been made. And so then religion becomes the pawn for people's violent tendencies.
Now, when you say that, you're saying that the people, the Islamist terrorists, haven't read the scriptures and understood them, or are you saying that the people, the non-Muslims, haven't?
I'm saying both.
Okay.
You will find that they may have read their scripture, but under the influence of a particular interpretation, politically motivated, are easily led or radicalized in a particular direction. So easily read, particularly because they have so little knowledge of the real understanding of the religion, it's very easy to lead them one way or another. Someone's a good speaker, someone a little charismatic, and bingo, you've got a following of crazy people.
And any thoughts on how the world should deal with something like that?
Well, again, the key thing is right understanding, and it is up to the religious leaders, it's up to everybody in society, but particularly the religious leaders, to provide the right understanding of their own faith. And my own spiritual teacher used to say, if religion cannot be a force for good, if it cannot be a force for unity, if it cannot be a force for harmony, then it has ceased to be one of its primary functions in society. Better to have no religion than for religion to be used for divisive purposes of hatred and political gain. So it is up to the religious leaders to first understand their own faith and then practice the tenets of their own faith in their true context. And if they can be leaders in the true sense, meaning examples of that teaching, then we're going to see the masses of humanity follow. But right now we have the opposite. We have people who are heading up these traditions, often in positions of power, which are promoting false beliefs. And the consequences we see already. And unfortunately, with the internet now, And with social media, these misguided messengers are able to reach great numbers of people.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You sit on an interfaith council, mm-hmm. at least one, maybe more. Do you see a response to that with the various religious leaders that they've recognized this problem and they're trying to get the word out, trying to do a better job, teaching their faith?
Absolutely. In fact, I want to just mention in passing that I just returned from the World Parliament of Religions, which is the largest religious spiritual gathering in the world, in Salt Lake City.
Where was that?
Salt Lake City, United States. And it was from October 16th to the 20th.
Right.
There were 10,000 people there from 75 countries and 50 different religions. And what we saw there was what should be happening around the world. These were people who truly understand the higher purpose of religion, who are putting that into practice, putting their faith into action. And what we saw there was what I call the beginnings of some new understandings, and which would give us cause for tremendous hope. And this is a moving away from what I call fossilized religions. And meaning fossilized, we mean people who are stuck in my religion is the only religion and all other religions are bad. And that belief is what I would call a kind of early developmental kind of childish belief that people have to go through in order to get to a more pluralistic or and then ultimately integrative approach to understanding spirituality, which is the wider piece of it. And so here's the good news. Not only did there was a tremendous focus on Islamophobia at this particular conference, but the religious leaders within the Islamic tradition, and particularly the Sufi tradition, stood up strongly, vehemently, and profoundly moving speeches declaring and giving guidance on the misguidedness of these jihadist groups. So that was a tremendously positive message. But what was also so powerful was that we heard the same message coming from very well-known Christian leaders from the Catholic tradition, from the Protestant tradition, Nobel Prize winners, very high participation from the U.S. government and from just about every other sect that you can think of, echoing these same essential messages. So the word is getting out there. The important thing is to keep widening that circle of influence, and that's why I'm always happy to talk about this over the radio, because hopefully we can get the message out to anybody who's listening to take a deeper look at what's really happening and don't just take the media bite as the truth.
Yeah, that is an issue. Our media certainly, you know, they try to sell airtime and papers, and fear seems to be a big, way to do that. And it certainly presents, probably creates more problems than it solves.
For sure.
Okay. I want to talk to you about mysticism. You've written a number of books on it. You've studied it. You know a great deal about mysticism, and I know almost nothing. And mysticism is probably as misunderstood a concept as in any of all religions. So could you help us understand a little bit about what is mysticism?
Well, the simplest definition, and it's simply a means to connect people to that experience we call God. So it's a path of reconnection in its simplest way. And those people who have trod that path, the contemplative path, we have called mystics. I think the term is probably a little confusing because somehow we have linked a mystic to the mystery.
Right.
And that can make things more confusing. The reality is spirituality, which is really identical to mysticism, is very, very simple. It's the path or the blueprint that people need to follow, regardless of age, sex, religion, nationality in order to experience that divine connection. So mysticism, rightly speaking, is simply the path that connects us to that divine power.
Now, does every one of the religions, the major religions, you know, there's a lot of them, but do all the major religions have a mystic element in them that they focus on a certain type of teaching as opposed to a lot of the dogma that you find in many religions?
Okay, so broadly speaking, we have two elements to all religions, what we call the esoteric and the exoteric. The exoteric is the outer side, the eso, the inner teachings. It's the esoteric side that deals with practices that connect you directly to that experience of divinity. The exoteric are what I call the prerequisites, or things that are helping factors along the way, and those may differ substantially based upon time, place, and culture. But the esoteric, and this is important for your readers to understand, is not only similar, it is remarkably identical. And that basically tells us that this is not something that belongs to anything, any particular religion. It is hardwired into the human condition. When we look at the experiences of mystics, of sages, of saints who have had this connection, regardless of religion, race, creed, time, epoch, we see that they all talk about their experiences in similar language and even talk about their inner experiences in using the language of light and sound. Now, here's the piece that I think people will be very interested to know, that prior to any written scripture, about, let's say, anywhere from 4,500 years ago, 3,500 BC, indigenous people have had similar experience describing their own experiences in their own languages that mirror and are identical to these experiences within religious traditions. So what does it tell you? It doesn't belong to any religion. It's hardwired in the human condition, so long as we follow some basic blueprints and guidelines. So it doesn't belong to a religion. It belongs to the human condition or humanity or to God.
So the exoteric portion of religion came along as a political tool, and it, you know, from a popular perspective, rose above the esoteric, which it kind of buried but kept within the religion. But if you weed away the exoteric, then you basically have a spiritual understanding, belief, set of principles, whatever, that crosses all of mankind.
Yes, and I would add to that by saying simply, look, the founders of all religions came. They had experiences of God, very high experience of God. And basically they said, look, this is not just for me alone, this is for everybody. And here is how you can have this experience. This is what you need to do. So they gave them inner spiritual practices that we know as meditation, contemplation, and prayer. And then they gave them outer guidelines to guide their life in the world, which we call the rites, the rituals, and what I call the ethical side to the human development. The ethical side is a prerequisite or a stepping stone to the inner spiritual connection. Then, as time passed, as the leaders were not there, what happened is many religions went into either stagnation or deterioration, focusing on the exterior and then adding more and more rites and rituals, confusing language, dogmas, and so on and so forth, and tended to forget about the real purpose, which is the inner experience of divinity. Now, whenever a spiritual master comes, they don't belong to that religion. They came before the religion. So there was no Christianity during Jesus' time. He was a Jew. So these religions actually were developed by their followers after they left. And there's where you get the exoteric development. So what we need to do as a society, we need to go back to the inner esoteric traditions and see How can we experience this divinity? That's what it's all about.
How do we do that?
Well, there are three basic prerequisites that all traditions talk about. And they're an essential for any spiritual life. And notice I am going to make a distinction between a spiritual and a religious life. One can be very religious, but not very spiritual. But one can be very spiritual and not very religious. The important thing is spirituality. And why do we say that? Because the important thing is your connection with the source, which is what religion is all supposed to be. So let's look at religions as schools of thought. The purpose is to get you to graduate and experience God. If it doesn't succeed in getting you to the experience of God, then it's like we dropped out of the school. All right. So what do we need? We need three things. We need a spiritual teacher, someone who's been there, done that, can provide guidance, knows the highways and the byways, the trials and the tribulations, because they've gone through it, and can provide appropriate guidance at every step of the journey. Second of all, they can connect us. They have the energetic power to connect us directly to that inner experience. And this is known in different traditions as initiation, diksha, namdan, and many different things like that. It's also been misunderstood in different ways. We'll talk more about that. Then we need practice. We actually have to put it in practice. And most traditions have a form of inward practice that concentrates the attention inside. We call it prayer with attention. We've called it meditation, dhyana, hetbut the dude in the Jewish tradition, zikr in the Sufi tradition, and so on and so forth. So all of those are inwardly focused practices that will connect. And the last, we need community. We need a support system in which we are human beings, we are humanly connected, and we need a community around which these practices can be supported and developed. And essentially, the idea of compassion, mercy, forgiveness can be exercised and developed. And so those are pretty much universal in all traditions.
Okay. Now, let's go to spiritual teachers. You know, there's an awful lot of stories out there of people running into embezzlers and, you know, and people taking advantage of their students and so on and so forth. How do you find, how do you tell if it's an authentic spiritual master or a fake?
Well, that is, I wish everybody was asking that question. That's precisely the kind of questions I like to hear, because this is exactly what we need to think about. First of all, we divide spiritual teachers into probably three or four categories, and I'd like to share with you. And these three or four categories are pretty much can be applied to other categories of in a secular context as well. For example, we have teachers who are just fakes and frauds, outright fakes and frauds. They're out there to make a buck. They're out there to deceive. They have purely egotistical motives for what they're doing. And you're going to find that, by the way, in any field of life, whether it's politics, whether it's academics, or whether it's business. You're going to find plenty of people like that. So it's going to be
no
in
question.
The field of spiritual. We have to be aware of that. Any sincere seeker should know there are going to be people out there. That's just the way it is. So the second category, people who are genuine teachers, they have made some progress on the way. They have developed ethically certain attributes of kindness, compassion. In other words, they're walking their talk, and they're not just promoting a particular religion. They're actually living it. All right. Who's an example? Mother Teresa. All right. Certainly Gandhi in another earlier era, and many, many known and unknown people. So they have made, and that range of progress can be anywhere from a little to a substantial amount of inner spiritual progress or revelation. And then we have the next category, which are those beings that in all traditions we talk about as the perfected human being, the being who has reached the full potential spiritually and is a manifestation, a full manifestation of all of the attributes of God realization. And we can talk about them as the God-man, the Satguru. We talk about the Christ figure. We talk about as the Adam Kadmon in the Jewish tradition. We talk about as the Murshidi Kamil in the Sufi tradition. We talk about as different traditions, all to that point that this is the full perfection of the human qualities. And they are in another category by themselves. That category is a very small category, right? Mm-hmm. But from our perspective, those teachers exist at all times. Maybe not a lot of them. Maybe only a very few at any given time. But many traditions believe, from an esoteric perspective, that the world exists for spiritual development, not the other way around. So we are human beings, not trying to have a spiritual experience. Rather, we are spiritual beings already having a human experience. What does this mean? This means that we're on an evolutionary journey, and the evolutionary journey can only be completed fully when we get the assistance of those who've already completed it. So many, many traditions espouse that there is always at least one perfected being on the planet, maybe known, maybe unknown, and doing this work, whether politics is aware of it or not, or whether they appear on Oprah or not. They don't need Oprah to get their job done.
Yeah, right. I suspect not. but that's interesting. So you say there's always one present,
yes,
on the earth at any given time.
And there can be more. But there's always one, because the purpose of evolution, which is what the evolutionary consciousness that we're here to develop, can only be completed with that. So this is, we find this in the Sufi tradition, we find it in the Jewish tradition, we have found it in also in Buddhism, and we also find it to a lesser extent in Hinduism and Jainism, but it's still there.
Okay.
So this is an important concept. These are things that ordinary people would not find unless you have an in-depth study of comparative religion.
Okay. Now number four, you had a fourth. You had fakes, genuine teachers are walking, yes, and the perfected human.
Okay, so you've got the fakes, you've got the people on the way, and then you've perfected. The fourth would be the perfected being, very small number.
Oh, okay.
And between two and three, you could say you could divide it into two finer categories and say that based upon the level of development. So, for example, those who have reached what we call the first plane of consciousness. So when we talk about cosmologies, most of the traditions have what we call inner cosmologies. They divide the world, they divide the spiritual universe into three or four general planes: physical universe, the astral, causal, and the purely spiritual regions. So someone who has gone up to the first spiritual region would be considered in that category three.
Okay.
Anyone who's up to that point, they would be category two. But it's very difficult for an ordinary human to ascertain those things unless they themselves are at that level. It's just like a first grader. How is he going to know who's got the PhD?
Yeah, right.
He can't figure out who's got the PhD. Only a comparable PhD is going to know it. So from the point of view of the ordinary seeker, what are the characteristics that you want to look for? Because that was your question. So number one, they better be walking their talk, number one. And sincere seekers should be vigilant and looking to see, is this a person of service? Is this a person who embodies the quality of compassion and forgiveness? That's number one. Number two, they should not be in it for any business, okay? Great teachers do not charge at the door. It's not a business, okay? They come, and it is always open to the public. Now, I'm not saying there are people out there who are charging for this and that, that might have some spiritual development. But at the highest level, it is completely egoless, and there's no outer profit or business involved. And that manifests. So, you know, Jesus didn't charge at the door. Neither did Moses. Neither did Muhammad. None of these people came. There was no individual selfish interest has been eliminated at that highest level.
Okay.
And the third category, which is really very important, is that an authentic or competent spiritual teacher has the energetic ability to give you a taste of that inner experience himself. He can actually energetically give that. In the same way that a live band, you know, your car is dead on the road, right? How do you revive it? You get someone who has a live battery, hook up the two batteries, right? Mm-hmm. And you transfer energy, right? Nobody says that's a miracle. Well, the same process occurs. A truly spiritual being is a live battery, and they can energetically transfer their energy to you at a higher level to give you a higher spiritual experience. So that ultimately is the most important piece of this, okay? So seekers out there should be vigilant. They should not trust the media. They should check out the person personally and do not throw their money or their devotion on anyone until they're thoroughly convinced, right? In the meantime, I recommend people just pray inwardly for direct guidance from that power that is already residing within us, that we may call God or Allah, whatever name, and that guidance will come.
Okay. Very interesting. Transformation. You talk about the human transformation. Could you talk a little about that? We're transforming from what to what? What are we transforming?
Okay, so what was the assumption that often is made, that is that when we come here as a human being, that we're somehow already complete. That's the assumption. And the reality is our body is complete, but our spiritual development is not complete. To one degree or another, we come, and most traditions, but not all, speak openly of what we call past lives or transmigration of the soul or reincarnation. So we have been evolving through the various species. And when we arrive at the human being, level of the human being, this is the opportunity in which we can fully realize the total capacities of being human. We're not there yet. It's like we're in first grade. So what are the qualities that we are looking to create in ourselves? Those qualities are the qualities of compassion, of mercy, kindness, of caring, of selflessness, charity, gratitude, insight. These are the qualities. We are not all there. Most of us, on a daily basis, are consumed in what the Buddhists call the five unskillful actions. And what are they? They are hurry and worry, agitation and restlessness, doubt and uncertainty, anger and depression.
Right. The world we live in.
It's the world we live in, right. So that, unfortunately, is what creates all of the pain and suffering we see in the world. Because people themselves are not the change they seek. So what did Gandhi say? Because I said something very powerful. He said, be the change you seek. Be an example. Example is better than precept. So the journey starts when we realize, look, I'm not complete. If I'm not complete, how can I expect other people to change if I'm not willing to change? So when we come to that basic realization that I have to be the example that I'm seeking in this world, then we can expect to see some real transformation, not only of the individual, but of families, of societies, of communities, of the nation, of the world. If individuals are not willing to make the changes themselves, how are communities and nations and families going to change?
In one of your books, I think it was Light Upon Light, I can't really remember, you say that there are seven core principles of transformation.
Oh, yes, okay.
Let me just read them, and maybe you can explain. Maybe you can explain them in a little bit of detail. The first one is deciding our aim in life. What's important about that?
Okay,
this is the first step.
The first step is we have to know why we're here. We have to know the value of the human life. And if we don't know the value of our human life, then we're going to miss the greatest opportunity of all. And the greatest opportunity of all is not to make a lot of money, and not to have a lot of possessions. It is to develop our soul. It's to become a truly conscious, compassionate human being. So if we can understand that as the first and the foremost important goal in our life, then we are well on our way to moving forward spiritually. If we do not get that piece of it, we don't have that right understanding of the tremendous gift of the human life. We don't understand the opportunities that are afforded the human being, then it's very easy for us to spend 60, 70, 80 years in our lives in outer activities that will not only change us, but won't change the world. We're accumulating wealth, power, prestige, name and fame, all of those things are ephemeral, not lasting, impermanent, and ultimately, most importantly, do not give us the happiness, the joy, or the love that we are actually hardwired to experience.
Okay, so we need to know what our purpose is and what our basic nature is. Priorities, first things first. That's number two.
Yeah, so even if we have that right understanding, okay, so let's say I got to that point in my life and I just realized, you know what, I need to start my spiritual journey. This is what this is all about. Now, the next thing is you have to actually create the priority and make it number one. So even if we have the conscious desire to make this our goal in our life, we actually have to implement it by making that the number one thing we do in our life. So that means changing our lifestyle. It means that there's going to be a transformation of our lifestyle so that we can include prayer, meditation, selfless service into our daily schedule. So we've got to take the priority and now implement it, make it actually number one. If it's number one, it should actually reflect that in the time that we devote to that activity in our life. Very simple example. Let's say I want to, my goal in a secular sense is to be a great athlete. Well, you know, I can't just do this on weekends. When you look at Michael Phelps, who won, 18 gold medals, he made it number one priority in his life, and it reflected in his daily schedule. I mean, spending 14, 15 hours a day prior to the Olympics training. So in the same sense, we have to apply these same principles to our spiritual life.
Okay. Seeing the end game. Number three, seeing the end game at the beginning. What end game are we talking about? The ultimate end game, or what are we talking about? Or the end game on a given life, or after several lives?
It's actually a combination of all those. But here's what it really, it has several levels of meaning. One is the level of immediate day. And then there's the level of how it relates to our thoughts. And then there's the level how it relates to our final end when we leave here. So when we say see the end and beginning, first of all, for thoughts, any thought or word or deed, before we do it, think it or say it, we should realize what is the effect of that thought, word, or deed on my journey and on the journey of other people and on their other lives. So instead of just blurting out anything, angry, hateful thoughts, we have to think to ourselves, what's going to be the effect of that thought on myself and other people? So that's at the micro level, at the individual level.
Okay.
The second thing we have to realize, because if we don't get to that level, we're going to self-sabotage with thoughts, words, and deeds that are going to undermine our overall goal. So, like an athlete, for example, he has to watch everything he eats. He has to watch everything that he does and who he hangs out with. He's got to pay attention to all those details if he's going to reach his goal. So, on the another level, we have to realize that all of us have a limited time on this planet. 60 years, 80 years, 70 years, 100 years if you're lucky, right? And that means that every moment is precious. It's a limited amount of time. And therefore, we should look at our life and say, is the life I'm living today taking me to my final goal? Is it taking me one step closer to where I want to go, or is it taking me further away from where I want to go? And this helps us hone in and focus in on transforming our day-to-day lives so that it's in accordance with our final goal and making each day, each hour, and each minute count.
Okay, I understand that. That's excellent. Four, regularity and habit.
Okay, so this is a big one that neuroscience has been discovering a lot about these days. So what we know about the human condition is that we are a bundle of habits. We're a bundle of thinking habits, emotional habits, physical habits, and so on and so forth. We can use habits to our great advantage. And so what we find is that when we want to change an old pattern, what's essential is to create a new pattern or habit that replaces it. And this is one of the great secrets of transformation, is that no matter how much you want something to change, intellectually, even emotionally, until you actually create a habit that replaces the old habit, we continue to default to the old habit. And so we actually have to create new habits that guide us toward our goal. And so that starts with first, and I'm going to quote something I've quoted in the book, which is, if we sow a thought, we reap an action. If we sow an action, we reap a habit. If we sow a habit, we reap a personality. If we sow a personality, we reap destiny. So it all goes back to, what are the habitual thoughts that we want to have going through our heads on a daily basis? That will set the tone for actually what we create on our daily basis. And developing those positive, life-affirming, not life-alienating habits are essential to our spiritual transformation. I'm just going to give you one example. Okay. Practice of meditation every day is a life-affirming habit. A gratitude practice every single day. A forgiveness practice every single day, that we take time to do these things. A compassionate action practice every single day, that we do not let a day go by that we don't reach out to someone compassionately, help them in some way. These are creating the habits that will turn into our spiritual nature.
Yeah, I really like that. Number five, 1 point focus and quality effort.
Okay. So in any field, and by the way, these seven points of transformation or seven principles of transformation apply to anything you do in life. Doesn't matter. You want to be a great piano player, a great wrestler, a great basketball player, doesn't make anything. You have to apply these same principles. And these principles, by the way, came out of my dissertation. I took a look at all of the transformational methods in all the different religious systems, as well as secular and sacred. And I came up with these because these were embedded in the traditions. So we talk about one-pointed focus, all right, and quality attention. No one has achieved anything with a half-hearted effort. Okay? We want to achieve anything in school, just not like at the academic level. I used to be a teacher. I'm retired now. Where does the A student, how does the A student become an A student? By burning the midnight oil. It's not because, you know, they're hanging out and partying 7 days a week. They were hitting the books, studying, and as a result of that one-pointed focus and effort, they achieved excellence in the field that they were studying in. And the same thing is true spiritually. We cannot go very far if we are not really sincerely committed to our practices and to achieving this goal. And that's anything, anything in life. You want to be a good writer, you want to be a good poet. It's the dedication to the craft. It's putting in your time. Now, there's an interesting book that Malcolm Gladwell wrote. Have you heard the book called The Tipping Point?
Yes.
And I think it was The Tipping Point. Correct me if I'm wrong. But in this tipping point, he's trying to figure out what leads to expertise in an area. What creates mastery in an area? What he found out, came up with what they called the 10,000-hour rule. And the 10,000-hour rule is, they said that anyone who achieved any level of mastery in anything, regardless of field, put in at least 10,000 hours in that field, right? So that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
And that 10,000-hour rule, okay, is what leads to total immersion and success in anything. And that's what we mean by one-pointed quality effort in anything we do. Okay. Even on our job, you know, who are the people who are going to get promoted? The people who are sitting back taking 2-hour tea breaks, I don't think the boss is going to promote them, right? So it is common sense, but we have to make it truly, on your show, common for everybody.
Right, exactly. Number six, patience and perseverance.
Okay, so this is, again, pretty obvious, pretty common stuff, but The bottom line is that nothing's going to be achieved overnight, and people are looking for instantaneous results, and any sphere, any activity are going to be very quickly disappointed. So nothing happens overnight. It takes time to develop everything. Just to get a high school degree, it takes about 1,300 hours. I calculated it out, all right? Just for a high school degree, right? Yeah. Which today doesn't have a lot of cachet, doesn't have a lot, doesn't pull much,
right?
So think of, when we think about how long it takes to be a doctor, to get a PhD, any of these things, we're looking at, you know, 10 and 12 and 14 years and so on and so forth. So let's be in it for the long haul. Anything you do, you have to be in it for the long haul. There has to be patience and perseverance, especially to get through the dry spells, the difficult spells. If we're not willing to see this as a marathon, I'm talking spiritually now, then things will come up, throw us off our course, and, you know, we'll never get back to it. So we have to see this as a long-term commitment. It's a lifeline, a lifetime commitment.
Right. And your final one, which I think I understand, flexibility and adjustment, 7.
So this is really about how you deal with the constant changing interruptions and constantly changing nature of our daily lives, the things that come up that we have no control over. So the example I give in my book is, you know, even on a pre-programmed computerized flight from New York to London, a typical pilot will make anywhere from 67 to 77 changes to the pre-programmed computerized flight based upon weather conditions, altitude, traffic patterns, and so on and so forth. Our problem, and the problem with most people who attempt anything in any secular sacred activity, is that they're not prepared to make those in-the-moment adjustments that are needed to keep you on track and your goals. So things come up in life, death of a loved one, we lose our job, all kinds of other scenarios. We go bankrupt, we get very seriously ill. These types of things we have to recognize are part of the journey. If we think they're not part of the journey, then when we get to them, they're going to throw us off course, and we're not going to get back to what we're really supposed to be doing. So we have to incorporate those and simply make adjustments without losing our course direction. So another level is very interesting. One of the things they found in neuroscience is one of the capacities they define as a genius, when they looked at some of the great, great thinkers and geniuses of time, is that their ability to learn continuously throughout their life without interruption was a sign of a truly great mind. Why? Because they're constantly taking in new information. They never get set in an old pattern and say, I know this, I know that, and I don't need any more information. That is a definition of genius from a neuroscientific point of view. From a spiritual point of view, it's the same thing. So the spiritual person is always taking in new information, always continuously learning, never blocking out everything, anything, because they know there's always more to learn, more to grow. So that essence, that's the essence of genius, and that's the essence of making be successful in anything.
I'm running out of time, and I have a couple more. Well, I have a lot of things to ask you, but I'm only going to get to a couple of them. Let's talk about ego, self to selflessness. That's an important point, I think. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, if you want to sum up all spirituality, that's it. From selfishness to selflessness. And this is, the selfishness is based upon a delusion of duality. We think we're these separate individuals in these separate bodies with no connection to the whole. And what science is telling us, even what quantum physics is telling us, what the great mystics and sages are telling us, is this is an illusion. This is a delusion, and an expensive delusion to be in. When we rise out of the self into the greater self, which is the universal self, we see we're all connected. And when we realize that we are all connected, that we're all one, that consciousness is actually one, we move into the areas of compassion and selflessness. We realize that whatever we are doing is going to affect us and affect everybody else. So we become much more compassionate, loving, caring human beings. We're we're out of the box of ego that can only think about itself. One of the definitions that the Dalai Lama gave, I thought was very useful in this connection. He said, if you want to be unhappy, think about only yourself. If you want to be happy, think about others, and not just think, but live for others.
Yeah, that's so excellent.
So, and I think that sums up the essence of the spiritual journey.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Now, before we wrap it up, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners about, you know, what you're doing or upcoming events or how they can contact you or you know, or anything along that line?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people are free to contact me on my website, which is I no longer do any consulting for fee. I offer everything for free now, but they can send me an email. I can also leave people with my email if people want to send me a note and direct them to any future events. And so that email, should I give it to them now?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. It's A, V for victory, I, D as in David, I as in ice, C as in Charlie, H as in Harry, K as in kite, I as in ice, R as in Robert, P as in Paul, A as in Andrew, and L as in Larry. It's avidikkarpal@gmail.com. Feel free to email me. I give talks and lectures and seminars and workshops. All talks and lectures are free to the public everywhere I go. There's not a charge for anything. And they're more than welcome, and I can direct people. I do a lot of talking in the East Coast and on the West Coast quite a bit also. The one parting message that I would like to leave with people is that the experience of divine love, which is an experience of total and complete love, is open and available to every human being. And if we approach this experience with the necessary guidance, with humility and grace, there is not anyone on the planet who cannot experience the deepest depths of divine and spiritual love. So it is just up to us to take the steps that we need to get to that experience. But it is available. It's not that God is punishing us or preventing us from having this. Each and everyone has that capacity to experience life in its complete fullness and in totality.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Andrew Vidic. And that's V-I-D-I-C-H for you listeners who want to get in touch with him.
Thank you
so much. It's been great to have you.
It's been my tremendous pleasure, David. Thank you again.
I look forward to sharing my thoughts with you every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern here on the Common Sense Spirituality Show. Also, all the old episodes are available on iHeartRadio.com. Remember, if you have any questions about today's show or suggestions about topics for future shows, then send me a note through my website at davidgagan.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly imagine. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.